This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
The real love story is the brothers, and so in a way that you would normally have romantic conflicts in situations like this, instead we had the bromantic conflicts, and that scene is one of my favorites. And I remember when we were even sitting around pitching it, I think there were some tears shed. I can't remember, but it's just, in fact, I think, Neil, you pitched it, and I cried, because I think you pretty much pitched it word for word.
If I pitched it, then I definitely cried while pitching it, too. So there was probably a mess in there, a lot of tissues.
Hello.
Wow. Marty's voice is huskier than I imagined.
Damon. Sure picked a great night to get lost in the woods.
Yeah, well, at least I'm starting to warm up.
Which, in case you didn't know, is a bad sign.
You gotta move.
Okay. Just pick a direction, start walking.
I can't.
I can't even feel my legs. At this point, I can't tell if the tremors are from my withdrawal or from me freezing to death. Stefan, just get up. This is not how you are going to die, Stefan Salvatore.
Alone in the wilderness, trapped in the frozen corpse of an alcoholic murderer. I don't know, seems kind of fitting to me.
Come on,
give me something to work with here.
Day late and the dollar short.
You suck at playing hero, brother.
Welcome back to Entertainment Weekly's Binge of The Vampire Diaries. I'm your host, Sam Heifel, and joining me to talk all things season 7 is executive producer Julie Pleck, writers Melinda Shue Taylor and Neil Reynolds, and Caroline Forbes herself, Candace King. As with every episode, I will just put it out there at the beginning that we will mostly talk about season 7, but we reserve the right to go forward in time to look back. So there is a series-wide spoiler alert on this baby. I've learned that I like to break the rules at the start of these podcast episodes, because I'm going to break that rule right now. Because we have Candace, I do want to throw it back very briefly before we dive into season 7, because one of my favorite things when rewatching the show, especially with someone new, is watching them react to Caroline in season 1, because, like, I know what's coming, but they don't. And I feel like Caroline just has such an amazing arc in those first seasons, yes, but throughout the series as a whole. What was your experience with it? Did you know when you auditioned for this, like, what was coming for this character?
No, I don't think anyone knew what was coming at all. I was just really excited, obviously, to have the opportunity to work with Kevin Williamson and Julie Pleck, number one, baseline. And then I was a WB kid. I grew up watching, like, everything on the WB that became the CW. So the idea of auditioning for a show that would be within that realm was exciting. And then I thought Caroline was a blast season 1. It blew my mind when people were like, ugh, she's so annoying, or she's just so mean. I was like, I like her. I think she's fun and vulnerable and messy.
He lives with his uncle up at the old Salvatore boarding house. He hasn't lived here since he was a kid. Military family, so they moved around a lot. He's a Gemini, and his favorite color is blue.
You got all of that in one day.
Oh, please. I got all that between third and fourth period. We're planning a June wedding.
One of the first things told to us as a cast was just to acknowledge the fact that we're all working on a vampire show and anyone can go at any time and no one should get too comfortable in their chairs. And so I really didn't know which direction Caroline was going to go. And I was very excited to see the opportunity of what she could become in season 2 and to ride that experience out with her.
Oh, hey, Blondie. I let you out.
I remember.
What do you remember?
I remember how you manipulated me. You pushed me around, abused me, erased my memories, fed on me.
You're crazy.
Well, the memories have been coming back in pieces.
You can't remember. It's impossible.
I mean, unless you were becoming a...
I have a message from Catherine. She said, game on.
Wait.
Obviously, this is the first season without Nina. And so you all, you knew her contract was ending. You knew she was going to leave the show. Was there a discussion of, like, do we move on? Like, do we even attempt this without her? Or was it a kind of an obvious, like, yeah, that could be fun?
Yeah, I think that... I mean, Nina was really, really upfront from the beginning, you know, when they started talking about season six, which they usually do a year or so prior, you know, she's like, I don't think I want to do more than six. And so in our heads, we always sort of knew that there would come that time where she could and probably would say no to continuing. And so I feel like none of us felt done. And I feel like none of the rest of the cast felt done. And certainly the fans didn't seem to want us to be done. So we just were like, all right, well, it's kind of a challenge. I mean, like, we've talked about this before, writing Elena, that Elena's the hardest character to write in the show, because the heroine is always the hardest character to write in any show, because as much as you want them to be fallible and layered and nuanced, inevitably you're always just combating the boring heroine problem. So I think there were part of us as writers, as much as we love Nina and Elena, that were like, ooh, a challenge, you know, let's see what we can do. And then we thought, well, finally, and I thought the shipper in my heart was like, finally, I get to get Stefan and Caroline. Like, finally. And then Candace threw the funny loop into that plan.
Yes. We will get to that for sure. But first, I want to start for Melinda and for Neil and for Julie, just for writers, as you all sit down to like break season seven, because you are missing Elena and you're adding this flash forward element to it. Like, there's a very different vibe to season seven in a lot of ways. Did breaking it feel different for you all in terms of like shifting a little bit for the show?
Yes. I mean, it's a short answer. we like the challenge of something that was a little format kind of spin of flash forwards. And those became really fun to puzzle out, kind of like, what's the thing that's relevant to the present day story? You know, how is it really important to see something that happens 3 years from now? And we also had to kind of figure out how those things strung together if you were to watch that show by itself, you know, sequentially, what are the flash forwards telling us? And how does that, you know, we can't get to this character moment till later, but we have to inform it with a character moment that's happening 3 years before. You know, I mean, Neil, what do you remember this time?
I remember that the format challenges that we bit off aside, we did spend a lot of time thinking about Damon in the absence of Elena and how to both honor, you know, the Sleeping Beauty spell and give him a primary heated sort of electric relationship. And I remember that the long arc of the season was actually a Damon and Bonnie season, and that it starts out with this really horrible betrayal where he considers for a fleeting moment, what would it be like to lose Bonnie to get Elena back?
So, which way do you want to go? Should we turn around? Or we should go straight? Maybe I'll left here.
And then the season moves him to the, you know, to be Bonnie's salvation by the end of it. And that to me is such a classic character arc structure that even though there are all these like layers of, you know, mythology and, you know, jumping around in front of it, like it was actually pretty easy to identify off of season six that it's like, this is a Damon and Bonnie season. It's always about the brothers. But in the absence of Elena, like Damon was framework for how the season would be structured. And Stefan and Caroline had the exact same sort of macro level discussion around it.
I remember that we had spent a couple of weeks at the beginning of the season breaking a lot of the big story arcs. And then I went off over to the originals room and I came back and Caroline Dries was like, the season's boring. I hate everything. There's not enough story here. And she's like, we need something new. We need a new framing device. And she pitched the flash forwards and my heart sank. Cause I'm like, I love storytelling and I love creative and complicated storyline. And I suck at math storylines where you have to like build the pieces to get to the thing. It's like, I can't write a heist story to save my life either. And I thought, well, this is the moment where I have to realize that I don't know how to do this. and never will know how to do this. And I just have to trust that Dreezy knows how to like lead the train on this. And thankfully we had a bunch of really great, like, gadget brains in our room, story gadget brains. Like, you know, all of you were so much better at it than I ever will be. And so you guys managed to like pull it through. Thank God.
Wow, that's very sweet. I would say of Julia that she's always the one who comes in and is like, yeah, but what's the thing that makes my heart break? You know, what's the thing where I'm like the teenage me thinks that's the one for me, that's my soulmate, you know? And it's so useful as a writer going forward from the show to just come back to those very visceral emotions and the things that make you lie awake at night.
I mean, talking about like Bonnie and Damon, the scene where she like says goodbye before he's about to desiccate himself, and then he's still like, Damon's done a lot of bad things. But the fact that he like still got in that coffin after that tearful goodbye is one of the most like devastating moments to me. That scene is so powerful. You mentioned we have Stefan and Caroline. They're going on their first date. But then you all bring in, with the heretics, the big villain of the season, you bring in Valerie. And I'm very interested, Melinda, I know you wrote kind of the episode that gave like their little mm-hmm. flashback love story. What was it about her kind of tying into Stefan's life and being that first love that really kind of intrigued you all about that story?
Well, we always love the thing that happens before the story, you know, and sort of like, what happened to Stefan when he was like a 16-year-old? And Paul Wesley was like, are you kidding me? I'm going to play a 16-year-old. He's very humble. But he totally pulled it off in that moment of like, oh, I think she's here. Oh, she's not, you know, and I think it's so relatable. That thing of you think you're being stood up, and yes, you are being stood up. You know, that's happened to you, or the kind of the way your heart beats and then it sinks again. But we wanted a thing that was kind of both pure but also fiery. You know, I remember how they filmed that love scene where he's sort of undressing her, and then as a writer, it's always very humbling when the costume designer is kind of like, I know you think this is how corsets work, but it's actually not. And then you kind of have to engineer the physics of what it's actually like to undress a woman in 1860, whatever. And, you know, I think we found a great actress was really able to connect with this kind of innocence, but also this promise of a thing that never happened. And it was so sad when we kind of came up with this idea that he'd had a child and Julian, you know, killed the child. And it was her kind of formative tragedy. And I don't know, we love epic tragedy.
When in doubt, epic tragedy always works. Mm-hmm. Candace, for you, though, you mentioned, like, I remember we talked about in season 4, we talked about what a big deal it is for an actor to want to cut their hair on a show. And, like, that's a big deal. When you know you're pregnant, were you at all, like, nervous to tell, like, Julian Company that you were pregnant?
I was very nervous. I also felt very strongly, for me personally, that I just wanted to wait. Regardless, like I did wait until I was, you know, past my first trimester, which made me even more nervous because like that really goes into the timeline of right when we were starting to film. But yes, I was very nervous to make that call, being like the first female actress to be pregnant and needing to film an entire season of television and throw that kind of curveball at the writers. So, but it was met with support and excitement and also, oh my gosh, okay, what are we going to do? It's going to be great, but what are we going to do?
Because, you know, I always love seeing if shows, you always have the option of the like, you know, conveniently placed lamp or whatever, and then you don't write in the pregnancy. Obviously, you all went the other route. What kind of went into that decision for you all?
I'm curious to hear what you guys
thought. The word lamp did come up.
I remember it so vividly, but I totally want to hear what it was like for Neil and Melinda when I walked into the room.
I think I remember making the strong argument. I came around, but to me at the beginning, it was like, okay, like, I don't care about the logistics of shooting the pregnancy because I had never done that before. And everyone who had been doing this for longer was like, you don't want to try to not show something that has to be shown, you know, in any master shot, in any coverage. Like, there was a series of logistics that I think Julie came in with very concerned about that I had no idea about. But I was in the camp of like, well, our mythology does not support a vampire pregnancy. And we actually told a lot of story about how vampires can't get pregnant. Like, that was kind of Elena's whole thing for a time. But our mythology, you know, if you're binging the show, you see that our mythology expands and contracts to fit the needs of the season. And I actually think that we did have one avenue in mind, which was the loss of Joe and the Gemini Coven. We had always sort of left that hanging on instinct. It's like, what was there some way that that wasn't like this horrifying triple tragedy? It was just the single tragedy, like Vampire Diaries tends to do so often. So that was my entry point to it. And I don't remember a lot of the rest. I don't remember, you know, what sold me on the storyline, other than I think a passionate argument that it would make good, interesting story.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that we were kind of like, how does Caroline feel about being, you know, an unwilling participant at first in this pregnancy? Or just kind of like, it happens to her. It's not something she had a say in. And we talked a lot about that and how important it was for us to feel as an audience and as a writer and as the cast, like, we embrace this as a good thing. So a lot of the conversations were really about that. Like, how do you get your head and your heart around this? Like, this thing happened to my body, which now I'm going to be on board with because, you know, I love these people around me and I'm all about keeping these kids alive. At the same time, it wasn't something I chose. It wasn't something I had in mind for myself. And, you know, what does that do to kind of your psychology and your emotions of the moment? So we talked a lot about that part of it.
Not possible.
What's not possible?
The babies. They're here.
Where? Huh? Floating in a raft in the Pacific Ocean somewhere? Look at the map. Your spell didn't work.
They're not on the map, Caroline. They're inside of you.
You know, when I got the call, I was a couple weeks into the story, and it was Candace and Stefan, you know, and leading lady, and it's time. It's going to be so hot and so sexy, and naked, and she called and she's like, I have news, and I'm pregnant. And I went, oh my god, did I think you were fucking with me? I think I might have thought you were pranking me. I'm not sure.
You said you had a dream. You said that you had a dream that, like, I was pregnant.
I'd had a dream.
And you were like, yeah, it was just a lot of like, ah, like a lot of noises, and just like, which now I understand, like, how much work had been done and how many episodes had been written. Because I told you literally the week before Comic-Con, I think. I mean, it was right before we were going back to film is when it timed out that I was in a more comfortable place to share the news on a bigger scale. Melinda, to what you're talking about, like, it's kind of happening to you. And, you know, there was a lot of that where I just was trying to navigate being so excited to be at the job that I love, but now under this whole new pretense of, like, well, now I can't really do stunts the way that I would normally do stunts, but I want to be a team player, and then my body's changing, and sometimes I looked very pregnant, and other times my belly would disappear and I'd be like supposed to be looking pregnant. It was just a very bizarre experience, to say the least.
I can't remember, because we had, because of the tragedy of the twins and Joe dying and one and looking for a story for Alaric for the season, we had separately come up with the story of the woman who knocks on his door and is like, I think I'm pregnant with your babies. And him being like, I don't think so. She's like, no, actually, like your actual babies. And so we'd kind of cooked that story up as a, can we really go down that road? That's pretty crazy. Like, womb transfer, magical uterine transfer, you know, like, we're already like, I don't know. And I can't remember if it was Dries or Brian or somebody. I wish I could decide who to give the credit to, but somehow the idea came up that we take Caroline and put her in that storyline. And so I'd already called Peter Roth and Mark Pedowitz, you know, the bosses, to tell him that Candace was pregnant. And I called him back and I said, so I'm about to pitch you the most bananas thing you will ever hear me pitch you. And I went into the whole pitch about the magical, like, embryonic transfer and the vampire who couldn't get pregnant, who's having babies. And I think it was Mark Pedowitz being like, Julie, believe it or not, that is not nearly the most bananas thing you've ever pitched me. And I was like, oh, good. Okay. And we're fine. And then that shaped, I mean, I always laugh, and we've said this before, Sam, to you, it's like, that decision to play into the pregnancy, to give birth to the Saltzman twins, to have Lizzie and Josie become part of the narrative while hope was existing in the other narrative of the originals, that is why Legacies exists, 100%. So mm-hmm. Candace's beautiful life miracle gave us a whole other show.
I'm always amazed too in rewatching it. There was like a little line at some point that was talking about some birthday party or something, but it was like Lizzie got mad and Josie cried. And I was like, oh, that still fully fits their characters, like in Legacies, however many years later. It's pretty incredible.
That's amazing.
So let's talk about the Phoenix Stone. The idea, is that something you all made up completely on your own? Is that like a thing somewhere that you all found? How did that kind of come about?
I feel like that was Adrie's idea. I think that she was thinking, what is Alaric going to do when he's so grief-stricken? And this is how Adrie's mind works in a good way. Naturally, you try to resurrect the person, you know? You like look for a mystical object that will give you the power of life and death. And we'll fix it that way, you know, instead of like going to therapy or something. And that became this thing where, you know, next thing you know, we've got a cool prop and we're in Europe and we're looking at, you know, different places to go for answers about this thing. And I don't remember when it came about that we decided that souls were trapped inside it and that there was a woman with a sword collecting them. Like you do. You know, I mean, Neil, what do you remember?
I just literally had to Google Phoenix Stone, by the way. That is how mushy my brain. I'm like, Phoenix Stone. I Google it. I'm like, oh, yeah, you mean the entire launching point of the whole villain mythology for the season? Oh, that, Phoenix Stone. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Different from the Moonstone.
Yes, no. Very.
Very different.
Two words.
Sorry,
two
Neil, words. You were about to be much smarter than I was. Please carry on.
Look, I had to do it's not Wikia anymore, it's fandom.com, but the Vampire Diaries wiki page is very helpful in reminding me because we churned through so much in 22 yeah. episodes. But I remember it was about the Huntress because the flash forwards were like, okay, someone's hunting them, mystery character, and like we do, we sort of introduce the villain before we cast them and we actually put them on screen. What are they after? And, you know, what's the new threat and the new promise of our mythologies? So we can bring the dead back to life, but like there's always consequences. So I sort of remember Reyna's character, who was the Phoenix sword bearer, the Huntress. Mm-hmm. She was, that all kind of came out of who she was. And then I think we detached the Phoenix Stone and gave it to Alaric in tandem to larger discussions about who the first villain was after the Heretic era.
I just remember it begat, right. The Phoenix Stone begat my favorite episode, which was the one you wrote that I directed, Neil, the Paul Wesley, Stefan Alter universe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Human for a day.
Yeah. Because he was stuck in...
Stuck in the body of Marty Hammond.
Marty.
Was that when he was a paramedic?
Yes.
Yeah.
Paramedic. Yeah. No. Paramedic was Tom. That was
season. Sorry. No, he was with the paramedics. He was being treated by paramedics as Marty.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
I think wasn't Marty a detoxing alcoholic who had just crashed a bus?
Yep.
My God. Poor guy. What a day.
Okay, I get the break, you know?
I do want to talk about that episode though, because I think, Julie, I think I've talked to you about this, but like that, the brother phone call in that episode when Stefan is in the snow and Damon's driving to him and Stefan finally gets to say, like, I don't believe you're going to save me.
You want to know why this is so hard? Because Marty Hammond is a total train wreck. Because eventually I'm not going to be able to go on.
When that happens,
I don't believe you'll be there.
But the entire tone of that episode and rewatching it, it's such a different episode for Vampire Diaries. Like, it always stands out in my mind. It's just a very different hour. And so, like, I'm very interested just Neil in writing it and Julian directing it. Like, when you were crafting it, I mean, were you having those kind of feelings? Was that intentional of like, this is going to be a very different episode of Vampire Diaries?
I think so. I think that I mean, we knew, Julie, that you were directing it. And so we had the advantage of, and this is not always the case in the way that our show was structured, but we got to sort of sit in a room together and just make an episode that we were really excited about from story break all the way through. Like, I think that it was meant to be self-contained because we knew that Julie would be shooting it. And so we'd be basically, the mythology would need to start moving again in the following episode. And we, you know, the next chapter would really start to pick up the end season run. And it was episode 17 that I think we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so it sits in this nice place in the season where we've built a lot, but we can take a breath before barreling towards the end too. And I just remember it being like a complicated setup for a simple execution. It was just a really simple story about the brothers' history and a little insight into their childhoods that, like, we, you know, hadn't really seen before.
Yeah. And I think it was like the byproduct of, you know, of losing Elena from their world. You have to ask yourself, like, what's the real love story? Mm-hmm. And the real love story is the brothers. Mm-hmm. And so in a way that you would normally have romantic conflict in situations like this, instead we had the bromantic conflict. And that scene is one of my favorites. And I remember when we were even sitting around pitching it, I think there were some tears shed. I can't remember, but it's just, in fact, I think, Neil, you pitched it and I cried because I think you pretty much pitched it word for word.
If I pitched it, then I definitely cried while pitching it too. So that's it was probably a mess in there. A lot of tissues.
Don't believe Neil, because Neil, like the height of drama emotion, this is like virtually indistinguishable from what you're seeing right now. Billy was crying.
That's always when the writer knows they have the win, is when they pitch and I cry. I cry at my own pitches all the time, but that's different. But I just remember, Neil, like, you and I were supposed to write that together, and I was busy, as I often ended up being, and so you wrote the first draft. And in my head, as I sat down to read it, I'm like, oh, this is great, because he did all the hard work, and then I'll come in and I'll, you know, I'll polish it up and I'll do my thing. And then I read it and I emailed you and I'm like, this is perfect. Like, you just wrote the perfect episode, and I am no longer co-writing it with you because it's now yours. And you just crushed it. I was so moved by it because it was a powerful episode. It had great stuff for Paul, you know, and Paul got so excited about that episode. Mm-hmm. He was so invested in it because, you know, after 7 years of Stefan, like, you know,
yeah.
I mean, he was over Stefan by like season 1.5, but, you know, 7 years later to get to, you know, to get dirty and to be human and to be running through the woods in handcuffs and to be in the side of a road dying bloody and, like, you know, just like playing a whole different character. He was so invested, and it was really fun to work with him in that way, in that episode too, to see him excited and invigorated mm-hmm. about the show again.
I remember a Bonnie storyline in that episode too. Isn't she chasing the Aurora Borealis across planets and dimensions or something? I loved it.
Was that the one? Yeah, because that's where she finally comes to face to face with the mom. Or is that the previous? That's the first episode I directed. Yeah, that's the Sheriff Forbes funeral episode when Bonnie is.
Oh,
yeah.
Geez. Oh.
Oh. Yeah, that one. That was a good one.
Okay, I'm gonna take that opportunity to jump to that episode really quickly, because Candace, that episode marked the second time you sang on the show, but a very different performance from the first time. What was your reaction? I assume Julie brought that to you and was like, would you like to sing? How did that kind of come about?
My reaction was, why do I have to do this again? It is very scary. And so I sang in season one. And then when Caroline's humanity was turned off, she sang again.
Oh, right.
I think there karaoke. Was like an audition and karaoke and then the funeral. And then it was literally like in a packed church with a bunch of extras and then the whole cast in the front row with just me singing.
Go in peace. Go in kindness. Go in love. Go in faith. Leave the day behind us, day is done. Go in grace. Let us go into the dark, not afraid, not alone. Let us hope by some good pleasure safely to arrive at home.
I was so tired and I just was like, oh my gosh, this is my nightmare. Like my voice shook. Like I break out. I'm like sweating thinking about it. I'll probably be bright red in 2 seconds. But I like that I did it and it's there. And honestly, that whole arc for Sheriff Forbes and Caroline losing her mother to glioblastoma was huge. I still have a lot of people that come up to me and just say that storyline got them through, whether it was a parent or a family member or a personal friend who passed from that cancer or any cancer. And so so I know how important that arc and that moment in particular is to so many people that watch the show. So to be a part of it was like on the receiving end of that is really powerful. But yeah, I don't need to sing any, but I was very done when it was like the singing was over.
Such a waste.
It makes me nervous. Unless I'm in a karaoke bar with a lot of cocktails in me, it's just, you know, I don't know. I get a little nervous.
So sad. So sad. I would write you singing all day, every day, and be so happy. No.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now back to the show. I want to get back to the Phoenix Stone of it all, because there are two really kind of Phoenix Stone central episodes that, Neil, you wrote the first one, and then Melinda, you wrote the one right after, which is where we actually go, we see inside of it, right? We follow Damon to kind of his version of hell. And then the next episode is very much so dealing with the effects when he thinks he kills Elena. There's all, he like really puts Tyler in a coma, which poor Tyler. But my biggest thing I remember when watching it was, oh, I would have loved to have heard the discussions of like, what is Damon's hell versus what is Stefan's hell? And because the Phoenix Stone ultimately is trying to teach them a lesson, right? And Damon's ends up being about his mom. Stefan's ends up being about Damon. But what kind of were the discussions for you all of like, yeah, like, we have this thing, we have to put them in hell. What do their hells look like?
Yeah, I feel like you pitched the Civil War thing, which I loved. I loved that episode. And for the drowning thing with Stefan, it was, you know, starts as a metaphor, ends up as a 100 and something gallon tank or however many thousands of gallons of water they built. Because I was like, well, it won't be this because we could never build a tank to do this. And then next thing you know, they're building a tank with a window and fire and God.
Season 7, baby. Really season 7, Pascal was like, what do you need?
I know. So we can build it.
I mean, that Civil War episode, though, Neil, my God, that might be one of our best, in my opinion.
Well, that was a collaboration with Holly Bricks was the other writer on that. And I can't remember who or when or collectively how we decided to do a Groundhog Day episode, but the structure is sort of perennial. And when you're talking about how do you represent hell, which I think there's a reason for it, which is that the repetition and the grind of it is fun. It sort of traps the character in and makes them ask the question, why is this happening? Why this day? Like, of all the days, this doesn't register on like you know, my wound scale. But then when you keep really pushing that over, over, and over, then it just becomes a therapy episode. And you're just trying to get to the core or the, you know, the deeper trauma. And at that point in the season, it had to be about Lily. Because I think Damon had like failed to say goodbye to her as she was dying. And so, you know, at that point in the season, it couldn't really be about Elena. You know, we had sort of like our consciousness had started to drift away from it. It's always about Stefan, but we sort of knew that Stefan was going to be about Damon. So we went into some Damon mommy issues and then just kind of wrapped it in a very dynamic Civil War shell.
I'm going to die knowing my own son hates me.
Yes, he does.
All the departments so pulled together and just he knocked it out of the park on that one. Just like they were excited too because it was different for them. But I mean, they put on a battlefield. Like they created the war kind of simulation, which was so great and so, you know, engaging and you know, kind of awful, but also wonderful because we got to see the inner Damon of before, you know, and I think that's something that's always fascinating. You know characters so well as their vampire selves and Damon's, you know, the one who says, for me to know and you to dot, 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 like he's that guy. When we meet him, but in the Civil War, he was a guy. He thought he was doing the right thing, you know, and he had this very tortured day.
And I remember like, you know, in season one when, because in the books, he was a Confederate soldier, right? And so we're like, all right, honor the books, make him a Confederate soldier, but he's a deserted soldier. And we sort of like gave two seconds of lip service to that in the first season. And then this was our sort of way of like telling the story of ultimately how he ended up no longer a Confederate soldier. But yeah, no, Deb Chow really crushed that. And Darren Janae,
oh my gosh,
Darren Janae shot it and Kara Stover built it. And I mean, my God, it was just a feat. You know, when you do a show that's like that long, when you see a good episode come together, you have almost like a greater sense of pride in a good episode in season 7 than you do in season 1, because they get harder and harder and harder to make great at a certain point. So that one was special.
Candace, for you, I want to get to, because this is a character at this point you've played for 7 years, but when they introduce something like a time jump and suddenly Caroline, it's 3 years into the future, which in her lifetime is not many, but for most people, 3 years is a decent amount of time. Obviously her life is very different in 3 years. What was it like for you to get to play? Like, did you feel in a way, did you kind of have to sit down and think, okay, in what ways is she different? Obviously she's a mom now. Do you kind of feel like you were like recrafting the character even a little bit?
I think that there were parallels that kind of caught up to themselves. Like my husband and I were married. I have two stepdaughters. I'd already been kind of in a new role within my own life. I was obviously about to give birth to my first child, and I did. More what I was concerned about was I spent most of the season being pregnant with twins, Caroline being pregnant with twins, but I only had one baby. So I never looked pregnant enough. So I'd have to wear a fake belly over my real belly to look more pregnant. And the Spanx and the mic pack and the bladder of a pregnant woman. And then all of a sudden, right before I was leaving for maternity leave, it was like, we're jumping 3 years in the future. And I was at like my most pregnant. And I was like, God, like literally this is the most pregnant, the biggest I'll be. And now we're jumping 3 years in the future. So that's where my head was at. But I was really excited to kind of see this new grown up maternal mama bear version of Caroline that I always think she had within her or that she kind of developed within her, that you would see within her friendships and also her relationships that she had. It is all a blur from sleepless nights after that. But I was ready. I was excited that she was kind of stepping into those shoes. And that we would explore that with the kids as well and see them in the future.
You got to work with adorable little girl. There are two little hands like siphoning the armory, and that is still one of them. It's so cute. It's adorable.
They were great.
I also feel like we have to talk about Matt, because in terms of like character, anytime Matt showed up in the season, I was always like, what's he doing? You know, is he suddenly it's like he's hating vampires. He has this beautiful love story with Penny. All these things are happening. I realized Julie, one question I've never asked, because obviously, like, Matt is the human, right? Like, Matt makes it. Was killing Matt ever on the table?
I would like you, after we answer this question, to ask it again when Brett Matthews comes for season 8.
Brett Matthews' okay. face just flashed.
Every day. Brett Matthews pitched that every day.
I had this thing about Matt Donovan that in a show that was just nothing but endless tragedy and death, that sort of like dopey cute guy from down the block, the human, should just be allowed to survive. And that was my thing. He was like the Xander to me. I'm like, he's just, you can't kill Matt Donovan. And I heard so many pitches that ended with, and Matt Donovan dies, that I think we put it into, what was that fake script page we wrote? Do you remember that? Like the, it was for the rap.
For the yearbook?
Yeah, for the yearbook. The writers wrote like fake script pages. And it's possible that even, and Matt Donovan dies is in there somewhere. It just became like a running joke. And hilariously, Brett literally on Legacy still to this day is like, and then Matt Donovan dies because Matt Donovan is guested in Legacy. So, you know, one day.
Who was for you all though? Like you, Julie, you mentioned Elena being a really difficult character to write in previous seasons. Who was the most difficult character to write in season 7?
That's a good question. I mean, Damon had a ton of good stuff. Season 7 was one of those years, probably Tyler. I mean, I feel like we were constantly struggling with Tyler, just through no fault of Trevino, because he's so great as Tyler. But like, we always kind of had a hard time. Like, he had had a nice run in season 6 with Penelope, with Luke and Penelope is the actress, Liv. Thank you. And 5 into 6. And so he'd had a nice run. And every time a character comes out of a really good run, then you're sort of like, now what do you do? And I feel like that was a struggle. Mm. But otherwise, like, it was a good, the good thing about season 7 was because everything was fresh, because it didn't have to be centered around Elena, we got to just exercise a new like set of writer muscles and story muscles, in spite of Dreezy deciding it's all terrible and that we needed to add the fetch words. Like, I felt like it wasn't easy, but at least there was like a never ending story supply. Whether the stories are good or not, you know, that's subjective, but I feel like the concepts were less difficult to come up with in season 7, and the characters were less difficult to service. But I might be wrong about that.
No, I remember it being a lot of fun. And the Heretics were whole cast of characters. You know, they all had kind of a similar power, if you will, but they had such their own problems and dynamics within the group. And then Enzo, you know, was such a fun addition to that, because we got to see his kind of relationship to all of them. And Annie Wershing, who played Mom Lily, right? She was great. Mm-hmm. She would add these things where, you know, just because she was so in the moment, there was a thing that was written as an act out where she's just like, she realizes that the Ascendant has been stolen, I think is what had happened. And that Enzo maybe tricked her into like letting her guard down for a minute, and she tells him to get out. And she gives him such a face. I mean, what a look she gave him for the act out, that on set I was like, let's add in vamp veins. Like, she's so pissed right now. That's awesome. Like, we can make this. We don't need the line. We just like have her, you know. So it's great to have her on the show.
Yeah, that was actually fun. The Heretics were a fun story engine too, because and the cast was really fun. Like Todd Lisance and Annie and Liz and Scarlett and Teresa, they were fun, you know? And they brought this like fun life into the show of like, you know, having a good time and being buddies and hanging out with each other. And, you know, everybody was so over each other, I think, by then. And it was just like, for us, it was nice to see like excited people, excited to come to work and enjoy themselves. And Mary Louise and Nora, you know, I mean, I don't know how it took us 7 years to have, you know, to have a queer relationship on our show that was substantial like that. But, you know, finally we did get to do it. And that was nice to play. And I don't know, there was fun stuff that season.
Bonnie and Enzo is one of my, oh, I love Bonnie and Enzo. They're so, did that come about? Was that like a on-screen chemistry? We have to write this? Like, where did the idea for, do people say Benzo come from?
Did we say that? That's right. Oh my God. I mean, I think it was at a certain point, it's kind of like, who can we pair up? Who has sure. And what would make sense? But also it made sense for the narrative. And they had great chemistry. And it was fun to see them start out, you know, kind of very antagonistic and then end up in this really wonderful place. It's very kind of unconditional, delightful relationship. And then, of course, we killed him.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
I love that. That's one of my favorite couples in the whole show is Bonnie and Enzo. And I think that there was something so, like, I was always the one, which, you know, has gotten me yelled at a lot over the years, but I just fundamentally believed that the Bonnie we met in season one, it would never date a vampire, you know, because, like, you know, everyone always wanted Bonnie and Damon to get together because of the books. And I was in my head, like, Damon is such an asshole and has done so many terrible things. And why would Bonnie ever, like, this Bonnie who's like so pure, why would she ever love Damon? And then finally I was able to, like, in my head, get Damon to a place where he was worth being loved by Bonnie in a friendship way. And building that best friendship was really, really, really great. And I loved that. And so once like Damon and Bonnie could be sort of besties after their prison world experience, then it sort of felt like, okay, Bonnie can fall in love with the right vampire, you know?
Loosen up your hands and there. And strap. Yeah, now back to the one chord. Right. There you go. That's it.
And Enzo's the right vampire, you know? I mean, he was a good one. He was a good man in his way. And I felt like that felt more in character with what she would have wanted, you know, for herself.
Yeah.
So I loved that one. And yes, we killed him because that's just what we do.
That's what we do.
Epic tragedy.
Did Malarkey played and sang on the show a little bit too, right?
At least
played guitar on this show, right? I just remember it was like, oh, what a serenade. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we mentioned that this is really like the season of Stefan and Caroline. Like, they finally go on their first date. They're finally on the same page about their feelings. Candace, in your experience, which are Steriline or Claroline fans louder in your life?
Claroline fans are way louder, always. Always.
Am I allowed to ask you on live camera where you stood on Claroline, or am I just asking for trouble?
We've talked about it a lot, yeah.
This has been a constant thing in all these little sessions.
Yeah, it's so funny. I never understood it. Like, I knew that, but I was like, oh, this is fun. Like, I love working with Joseph Morgan, but it just took off in a way that I think even as the writers, like you guys were, we were all surprised. It became its like own like Twitter thing. And so, and I loved that everyone kind of just got like little samples of it throughout, you know, the years. But I liked the slow burn of Caroline and Stefan. Like when I watch TV, those mm-hmm. are the kind of like slow burn relationships that that I am usually rooting for. But I just thought it was so funny. Yeah, still, it's always like Claroline all the time. Yeah, I hear that word a lot. What a word.
I also personally think Tyler and Caroline don't get enough credit because I loved that relationship too.
I do remember though, when the pregnancy storyline came about, the question was like, well, who is it? Because Caroline had already been dating every single person so far. Like it literally came down to Alaric and Caroline at the end. Yeah, which was so funny. Yeah, so because I always forget that Trevino and my characters dated and that like all the, I'm like, oh yeah, it's usually like fans or fan conventions that'll be like, and then when this relationship with Caroline, I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot that one too. That was a whole chapter. But yes, just a lot of love. No,
that's all your fault, Candace, because you just, you're just one of those actors that has chemistry with everybody. You literally have your face just like exudes chemistry with whoever you're acting against. And so when, as writers, you see that on the screen, you're like, look, that's so, they have such chemistry. And then you write to that, and then you destroy that relationship, because that's what we do. And then you, like, you know, put her in a random scene with a random character, mm-hmm. and then, oh, look at all that chemistry. And then there's more there. And it was always fun to give Caroline those relationships, because like the mm-hmm. character just blossoms with the first crush, the first kiss, the first blush of new potential and all that.
Yeah.
but yeah, she did get around. No shame. Neil, isn't this the season where, like, maybe it was six, where like all the, where was the throwing Caroline over the shoulder and locking her in the trunk of the car and taking her to the hotel room?
But it was not a trunk of a car, because that was pitched to me, like, because I was like 7 months pregnant. And it was like, so here's the deal. We're going to put you in a car, but there will be holes in it so you can breathe. And I literally have pictures of how pregnant I am at this point, with like blood down my face and a knife, fake knife in my belly. And I was like, I don't know about a trunk of a car. And they're like, okay, well, what about a wardrobe case? So I was locked in like a wardrobe case with my hands tied and my mouth gagged, and then just like being like, well, just another day at the office, just very pregnant.
I just remember it was about season 6 or 7 that the conversations about the conversations that are so prevalent today, like, you know, in terms of a woman's agency and what's misogynistic and what's toxic and what's rapey and like all those things, started coming up in the writer's room fairly regularly. And it was like so enlightening, because I literally would sit there and be like, oh my God, everything that we've done leading up to this moment is so problematic. And yet, like, was okay when we started, but like, I don't know if this show is going to hold up over time, because it's so problematic. And then I would say to the room, I'm like, if we can't write like gothic bodice ripping heat and romance, like the, like we used to, and the Harlequins, like, I think we're all out of a job. Like, I don't know how to do it. And it was like a big shift, because you guys were all super, super sensitive and in all the best ways about that. And it took me so long to catch up to it, because I just, you know, when we started the show, it was like 50 Shades of Grey was all the thing, and Twilight, where like Bella's basically just a, you know, sort of a passive instrument of Edward's desires, and like all those things, like, in the beginning, not forever. Don't yell at me. and everything, like Damon and Caroline in those early episodes, you know, all of it was so ultimately not good. and I laugh only because what else are you supposed to do? But yeah, those conversations were really, really powerful, because, yeah, Neil, you can elaborate.
I remember now that this centered this particular, there were multiple times that Caroline Forbes was abducted and tied up, I think, in this season.
Yes.
Because this one centered around Stefan doing it as a pseudo-romantic, like, I'm getting you out of danger mood.
Oh, good. You're up.
Did you seriously just vervain me?
Yep.
Is this a hostage situation?
Be mad all you want, just do it while you're looking at these.
Hong Kong, yeah, that's really funny.
All that matters is that we get moving and we stay moving now.
We? There's no such thing as we, Stefan. There hasn't been for a very long time.
Fine, if you want to do this alone, that's your choice.
Oh, how ironic, considering that the only reason I'm even here is that you decided to go all caveman and kidnap me against my will. This is not you. You usually respect people's choices.
Yeah, until it comes to life and death, and then it's not up for discussion.
There's always a choice. You gave Elena that choice.
And then I lost her. Elena asked me to rescue her friend from the bottom of a river instead of her, and she died because I respected her damn choice.
Now, maybe one day you'll wake up and realize that I deserve the same respect that she did.
And so the nuance of that was a really tough thing to parse, where it's like in the bodice ripping tradition, then, like, you know, can't Stefan be a fucking alpha male for one protective hero move, and shouldn't we celebrate that? And yet, I mean, I was, you know, I was concerned. And I think that ultimately I don't remember how we reached a compromise, but in the end, like, I think we softened some of what was how the abduction was happening. The way that, you know, you pitch these things, you know, in the room, it's like you start off And the knee-jerk reaction is like, well, he just...
No, he breaks her neck and throws her over his shoulder and throws her into the trunk.
He snaps her neck. He just snaps her neck.
Shame.
She's not pregnant anymore. He just snaps her neck and goes. You know? Like, it's terrible.
Well, this was also a flashback, or this was a flashback or a flash forward to when Caroline was not pregnant. So the character was not pregnant anymore. It was just, I happened to be physically pregnant.
Yeah. Oh, correct. Yes. No, it was, he was in danger and you didn't want to leave him. And somehow, like, and so he, you know, he knocked you out, like, and took you and, like, took you to this hotel room, because, you know, everything sexy happens in a motel room by the road, you know?
Yeah.
That's just right. The basic rule.
We made it sexy,
television.
Yeah. Very next scene is just one of those sterile scenes where they talk about feelings. And so mm-hmm. The abruptness of the transition from, I'm going to take you out of our danger, you know, sort of like without even asking you if you want to. And then just being like, but this is a romantic story. I think that whiplash is what we tried so hard to massage, knowing the problematic area that we were in. And ultimately, I think we solved it. If we solved it, mm-hmm. we solved it with tone and just mm-hmm. like good direction and great performances mm-hmm. and understanding that, like, we are treading in these waters. Yeah. And I think Caroline chewed him out for it, as she rightfully mm-hmm. should have. Like, you fucking kidnapped me. But that's always just the bridge to, like, well, why do you care so much that you would kidnap me? we're sliding back toward problematic bodice ripping romance again, but, you know, it did our best.
Yeah, it's a difficult line, because I feel like some of the appeal of vampire stories is that they're such passionate, you know, kind of overly kind of, I don't know, externalized feelings that people have, and that you wish you could have this kind of amazing experience, and then, you know, meanwhile your real life is not like that. But in the safe space of, like, vampire fiction, it's okay for people's hearts to get ripped out of their chests, literally, and it's okay for people to run off and do crazy things and be in a car accident and walk away and then talk about, you know, their childhood. You know? If only real life were that simple.
Yeah, there's not a lot of vampire folklore where it's like, and then everyone, like, sat down and talked about their feelings and had really stable
and
relationships.
Yeah.
Quietly negotiated, stopped at 5, came back the next day, resumed talk.
May I bite your neck and feed on you?
Yeah, exactly. Can I please feed on you? Vampires are by definition right. like predatory sexual beings, you know, and that was always the sort of heat and allure of the genre in a different time. And so we started making this show when that heat was still palpable and still somehow acceptable to enough people, I guess. And certainly, you know, that it our society shifted underneath that, I think.
The last thing I will just throw at you guys is, you know, the finale, you're building toward whatever is in this vault. Did you know it was a siren in that, or were you just like, creepy hands and we'll figure it out later?
Somewhere between those two things, I think. I remember that we didn't know the full visual of it. I remember we animated this hand for the Comic-Con teaser, the sizzle thing. And there were a lot of conversations like, how long are the nails? Do we hear the, you know, is it blood dripping? Is it coming out of a vat? Is it just like by itself? And it grabs their faces and it pulls them back. What's its power exactly? We suggested a lot of things with that little sizzle, like it's 4 seconds of a monster animated thing. And it's very evocative and it's cool because we feel like our people are in jeopardy. But we knew it would be sexy. You know, I think we knew that it would be something that had to be so powerful and dangerous that they needed to lock it up in this weird cavern thing. And, you know, it was an opportunity to cast some really interesting actresses the following season, and a different kind of sibling rivalry emerges.
I should warn you, it doesn't always work out so great.
I had a feeling. But don't worry. It's not as bad as you think. It only hurts at first. And after that, it's kind of fun.
Neil, correct me if I'm wrong, because I remember, like, when we shot it, you had to sort of, we had to tell the boys to, like, yeah, just, like, react like something really fucked up is grabbing you, because we had no idea. And then even with the creature, because we wanted something big and scary. And it was our first foray into like creature effects, because, you know, we never had monsters on Vampire Diaries. And then we kind of had to backfill when we really landed on the sirens. We had to backfill why the siren who would step out of that vat as Natalie Kelly would have those claws, in that little dark room. And so we had to like kind of create that mythology that she was like being like essentially all the life sucked out of her and living in that blood vat. But yeah, we kind of, we did backfill it a little. I think we knew sirens, but I don't think we knew how to make it work until we got into the room for the next season.
Yeah. It was, if I remember right too, even before we were like, what's the creature? It was in service of, at the end of season 7, what are we excited about that's launching us? And it was like Damon and Enzo off the rails and literally saying, Stefan saying something like, Elena, don't worry about it. Anything Damon does from this point forward is not his fault and won't jeopardize his relationship with you. Like, we actually worked really hard to give season 7 this like bow where it's like how Damon acts in the absence of Elena. Can he still be good without her? Basically, he succeeds in that, primarily with Bonnie. And then Stefan's like, oh, but he got possessed. So like, this doesn't count. But hey, audience, so what are you psyched about? Tune in to see Damon and Enzo just fucking killing people and going back to a joyous sort of like murder spree that we remember Damon being in possession of from earlier seasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that card, the magnetic cards on the dry erase board. It just says Damon and Enzo off the rails. It was just there, like the end of the finale. It just was sitting there by itself. There was a big white space above it because we didn't know how we got there. We knew that would be a final moment. And then it became, I remember coming into season 8, Julie was like, everybody needs to watch season 1. Look at the pacing, look at the emotions. We're going to go back to basics for our, you know, bring it home season. And it was so satisfying to kind of feel like, okay, we're starting out with a kind of classic two kids on the road, or there was a tent, or it was a very season 1 vibe. And then it turned into this whole other thing. But it was so cool. It was kind of like all the way along in season 8, this kind of like acknowledging where we'd come from.
When did we ditch the malarkey as Enzo as the other Salvatore brother pitch?
Oh, man. Oh, my gosh. I remember vividly. he was going to be the third Salvatore brother. And all the conversations about introducing his character were kind of like, how do we get this kid who was left behind in the prison? And I think probably during the break of 509 was kind of what we realized, the math just doesn't work out. You know, there are too many things get closed off to us. If we make him the third brother, also, where did he ever come from? You know, and there's so much more opportunity for a guy who was just like almost like a wartime buddy, you know, like that kind of bonding of two fellow prisoners, and that their friendship was like a brotherly bond, but not actually siblings, so that we didn't have to do all of the kind of retrofitting. So I'd say pretty early on in the fifth season, we kind of thought that would be so cool, but even we cannot pull that off. Let's make him a cool guy.
But we did manage to capture some of the spirit of that in the Enzo-Lily relationship, because Lily, an actual Salvatore mother, Enzo had this weird, you know, psychosexual, you know, mom figure attraction to her that age-wise, you know, it doesn't register when you're in vampire world. But like, I do remember we sort of captured the spirit of why Enzo would be, you know, obsessed with a Salvatore mom, and kind of got at it from a different way.
Right, because she turned him, as I remember, right? And that's why they had this kind of, in a sense, he had an honorary sibling relationship.
They have a kiss in season 7. There's that moment, yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. There's no, you know.
No judgment here.
Well, before we wrap up, does anybody else have any other season 7 thoughts? Has this conversation brought anything else up for you all?
Just the task that was at hand and how wonderful you guys all did as writers in, you know, just delivering storyline after storyline, and not even just that, but like each episode having a hook that would always deliver into the next episode. I mean, 7 years in, that is incredible. So, I mean, the fact that you guys can even go back and remember all these big twists and turns from a writer's room so many years ago is impressive. So well done, guys.
And I would, I guess, say R.I.P. Stefan's Porsche.
Oh, yes.
I was pretty agnostic on the Porsche, but I know some people didn't like
that
it at all.
That was devastating.
But some people dearly loved it.
I remember it being small. Am I right? Was that the granny mobile? Yeah. Very it was just, small. It looks great on screen. And then you put two tall guys in it. And you're like, wait a minute. We can't get a camera in there. This thing is vintage.
It ain't sexy. Nothing sexy about it in real life. It just looks sexy.
Oh, incredible. All right. Well, thank you all so much for doing this. And for anyone watching or listening, we will be back to talk all things season 8.